Hi, and welcome to the Jewish Review of Books podcast. I'm Abe Sosher, your host and the editor of the JRB. Today I'll be talking with two great Israeli writers, my friends Ben Balint and Mati Friedman. Ben's most recent book, Bruno Schultz, An Artist, A Murder, and the Hijacking of History, just won a 2024 National Jewish Book Award, and it's up for several others. Mati is also an award-winning author. His most recent book was Who by Fire? Leonard Cohen in the Sinai, which was about Cohen's remarkable singing tour of the front lines during the 73 Yom Kippur War. In our winter issue, Mati wrote a brilliant essay on Chaim Sabato's now classic memoir of being a tank gunner in the Sinai. And Ben dived into Deborah Lipstadt's new biography of Golda Meir for Yale's Jewish Live series. Both of their essays are deeply marked by the horrific events of October 7th and the present war in Gaza. And we talked about the Israeli experience of both of these wars. It's a fascinating discussion, and I learned a lot from it. I think you will too. Mati, Ben, it's good to see you. You both wrote brilliant pieces in our current issue. Ben on Deborah Lipstadt's recent biography of Golda Meir, which is more relevant than one would like. And Mati, you reread Chaim Sabato's great memoir of the Yom Kippur War, of being a tank gunner in the Yom Kippur, Tu'um Kavanot, Adjusted Sights. First, a general question. You were both writing them, these pieces, in the aftermath of October 7th. In fact, that's, of course, how we came to these pieces. What was it like to be writing about the Yom Kippur War during the Gaza War?
Sure, I'm happy to start on it, and I want to thank you, Abe, for inviting me and Mati on. I'll tell you what I was thinking when you first asked me to write about Golda Meir, which is a very simple question, and that is, how soon is too soon to write about the history of an earth-shattering event? This happens to be something that Mati and I have spoken about several times in person. Your readers and listeners may not know that Mati is something of a World War I literature buff. And a couple of years ago, he lent me a copy of Goodbye to All That, the memoir of the First World War by Robert Graves. And I was astonished to see that that first appeared in 1929. Not in 1919, not in 1920, but over a decade after the events that it describes. And I was thinking about that when I first got your invitation to write about Golda and to start thinking about the current crisis in the historical lens of 73. One of the most famous books about the French Revolution was the Scottish essayist Thomas Carlyle. And a reviewer complained that it was too soon for him to write about it. And that was a half century after the events. On the other hand, as Mati also knows, Winston Churchill published the 600-page Gathering Storm book just 4 years after the end of the Second World War. So in any case, what I want to say is I was thinking how for people who have just lived through a crisis like this, it's also a question of needing time to be able to listen and to be able to read. I was separately reading the other day one of the most significant books on the Shoah, Raoul Hilberg's Destruction of the European Jews. And I saw that it was written in 1948, but not published in the US until 1961 because people were just not ready to hear it. So that's just all a long-winded way of saying, for all of us, we're thinking about how we can look to these historical resonances precisely because we can't look into the future because the future seems so uncertain. We're all the more tempted to look into the past for some guidance.
Mati?
Ben and I have spoken a few times about the dangers of writing about moving targets. You know, there's a kind of a temptation, I think, for journalists to write a book about an event that's fresh and there's a lot of interest in it. And I've been asked a few times if I'm planning a book about, you know, October 7th and the war in Gaza. And I think it's, you know, it's way too soon to know what just happened, let alone what the significance of it is going to be. And I learned that actually, I don't want to say the hard way, but I definitely learned it in a personal way when I tried to write a book about my own experiences in the army in Lebanon in the late 1990s. I tried to write the book immediately after getting out of the army in the year 2000, and it was terrible. I don't think I knew that at the time. And I couldn't get any traction with it. I wrote a whole manuscript about it and had to eventually shelve it. And I was very disappointed. And then I went back to it more than a decade later. And it turned out to have needed that kind of time just to understand what had happened and to put it in some kind of perspective. So I think it's going to take us many years to really understand the significance of what just happened. And I think that the significance of what just happened depends on what happens this year. Will there be a war in the North? Will there be a broader war in the Middle East? How do the echoes of this event play out between Israelis and Palestinians and between Jews in the Middle East and the Muslim population of the Middle East? And these are all big, big questions. So I have no doubt that we'll be thinking and writing about this, 50 years later, just as Ben wrote his wonderful essay about Golda 50 years after the 73 war. I'm not sure it's going to be me and Ben and you, Abe, writing about it, but there's no question that we're in an event that is of that stature and that will require a great deal of time to process.
I should just say that you mentioned your book, but you didn't mention the title. Pumpkin Flowers, your book about the Lebanon War, is a great book. Tell us about Chaim Sabato, who's a somewhat unique Israeli author, and about this memoir, Adjusted Sights in English.
I was very happy for that suggestion. First of all, it's a great suggestion and an opportunity to return to a book that I loved when I read it the first time about 20 years ago, but also because when you gave me the suggestion, it was, I think, about a month into the war. I was having a really hard time thinking. It was very hard for me to think about what I should write or if I should write, and everything that I wrote seemed to be ridiculous given the weight of the events. And I thought that was just a great suggestion, and it helped my brain come back online. So I'm grateful to you for the for the proposal. Chaim Sabato doesn't come from the usual scene of people who write about Israel for Israelis in Hebrew. He doesn't come from Tel Aviv. He's not secular. He's a rabbi. Today he heads a yeshiva in Ma'ale Adumim, which is a settlement not far away from Jerusalem. He comes from a long line of rabbis, a family from Aleppo, Syria, originally. And he comes from of religious Israel and Mizrahi Israel, and he grew up in a poor immigrant neighborhood in Jerusalem and was not part of the usual arts scene. So he kind of came out of nowhere with this book, which is today recognized as one of the best Israeli war memoirs. And interestingly, it's one of the very few books of any literary value that have been written here by ordinary soldiers. And that's very striking, I think, considering the extent to which Israel has been defined by wars. So there's lots of writing by historians, military historians. There's lots of writing by generals and senior officers, but we have almost no writing by ordinary soldiers, which is strange considering how literary the country is and how many people have been touched by war. But right. Amos Oz fought in wars, but never wrote a great book about wars. And the same is true for other Israeli authors. So Sabato kind of came out of this tank. He was in the thick of it on the Golan Heights in 1973, sat on the experiences for about 25 years. As Ben was saying, it takes a really long time for significant war writing to come out. People, I think, expect responses to be very rapid. Certainly now in the age of Twitter, you're supposed to come back from something really traumatic and sum it up in a tweet the same day. But almost all of the memorable war literature is written long after the war in question. The Things They Carried, which is Tim O'Brien's masterpiece about the Vietnam War, comes out more than 20 years after O'Brien comes back from Vietnam. And there's a great example of this in Israeli war literature, 1948, and it's by the writer Yoram Kanyuk, who wrote about his experience as a teenager in the Independence War of 1948, but it came out in 2010. It took him 60 years to nail it down. So I think it's not surprising that Sabato took 25 years before coming out with a book that was unique for representing the view of a low-ranking soldier, and also unique for being very religious in its presentation, very kind of steeped in Jewish texts and Jewish traditions. It's not influenced by the great war writers of the English world. It's not clear to me at all that Sabato has ever read those writers. He's definitely read the Bible, and he's definitely read Agunon. But I don't think he cares very much about international literature. And that is one thing that makes his book so special and so uniquely Israeli.
You say that like Agnon, there's this, deep intertextual sense, this imbrication or something of rabbinic literature and so on, that it's, there's Maharal, the Maharal of Prague, and you know, Nachdimon Ben Gurion negotiating with the Romans and so on. Tell us a little bit about the literary experience of reading this book, and was it as good as you had remembered?
When I spoke to Sabato, he told me that the book doesn't have a chronological order, it has an emotional order. So he just sat down and he wrote about the experience the way he thought about it, which means that it jumps from his childhood into the war. And then a few pages into the book, we're out of the war and it's after the war. And then we're back in the war and then we're in the Mishnah. And, you know, then we're in the Book of Numbers or something. And you know, then the Romans are there, and then Rommel is there, and then it's the Crusades. And then, so it's really Talmudic in that way. The Talmud jumps around. We have these incredible conversations between rabbis who are arguing with each other, even though they live in different centuries. There's this total disrespect for chronology, and which is amazing, of course, because the Jews really do memory and not history. They're not really that interested in exactly when things happened or in what order. The question is how you remember them and what did they mean. And he very much comes from that world, and that's how he presents his war. So it can be quite a confusing read if you're expecting a straight war memoir. You know, we were called up, got in our tanks, we drove up to the Golan Heights, we were attacked by the Syrians at Nafah, and all of that happens. You can put it together if you read the whole book, but that's not what the book is trying to say. It's not a book for military historians. He's not trying to explain to you the course of the Yom Kippur War. He's trying to say something much deeper. I think he's trying to place himself and his war in Jewish history and in Jewish memory. And it's a big, I mean, saying it's a big mess sounds like a criticism. I mean, it's not. It's kind of a big mess in the way the Talmud is a big mess. It's a different kind of book. You have to understand what he's up to. And I think that it's a very successful book. It's very much himself. He told me that he wrote it in the course of one night, and he had to stop because his wife said, "Chaim, you have to stop." She got worried about him because he was, I guess, still awake in the morning at his computer. And that's how it came out. And that's really what it feels like. He says it was not edited or barely edited after that. And it really feels like that. It was as good when I went back to it as I remembered. Although, as I read in the piece, my take on the religious and political world that Sabato comes from is different. And it, because the role of religious Zionism in Israel is different than it was 20 years ago. And the voices of radicals and fundamentalists in that camp are much more potent and much more dangerous today than they were then. And the events of last year leading up to October 7th are a good example of the rising power of some very unhinged people who speak for that camp or claim to speak for that camp. And it's harder, I think, to see this voice as kind of an interesting, exotic voice from the margins when you realize that, you know, that the far right here wields real power in Israel. But Sabato is very much not that. So the context has changed, and it makes the way you read the book different. But Sabato's book is not at all a militaristic book. He doesn't come from that line of religious Zionist thinking. There's nothing in the book about the glory of war. There's nothing in the book about the redemption of land. Sabato would never claim to know God's plan. War is a tragedy. War is a test. The war exists in a continuum of Jewish history. He's not speaking in the way that we've heard so many religious Zionist leaders speak in the past few years. So you have to kind of cancel out a lot of the noise in order to read the book with the attention and with the sympathy that it deserves.
And then did you find it welcoming in that sense, that it's this religious Zionist voice that is not martial, not sure of its messianic premises, say?
Yes, it's a reminder that there are other voices in the world of religious Zionism. It's not coincidental that Sabato's family comes from the Middle East, and he's speaking a different language. And the book, I think, is an example of the richness that you can draw from a religious tradition, and a reminder that it doesn't have to be taken in the direction of kind of crude nationalism or the cancellation of the rights of people who aren't Jewish. Something much more complicated is going on in Sabato's book, and it's very welcome. Although it also doesn't admit to many flaws in the tradition or in the edifice of Jewish, you know, ritual and culture. It's very much, I think, the book of an educator and a rabbi. He's the head of a yeshiva. He's a Rosh Yeshiva. He's responsible for hundreds of students, and he won't be able to come out whatever he thinks in the deep corners of his heart. He won't be able to come out and, you know, really give a voice, for example, to a soldier who, because of his experience in the Yom Kippur War, decides that God is dead and never puts tefillin on again. He can't make that kind of allowance. He can't doubt it. And if there's a flaw in the book, it's the lack of the flaw in the narrator and in his religious belief.
So let's pick up on that, the shock of the Yom Kippur War, of the attack on Yom Kippur in 1973 on October 6th. Ben, how does Golda's life lead up to this moment? That is, in what ways are both the extraordinary failure of ignoring all the signs and thinking we were safe, how does her life come to that point as prime minister? But also, then she's very successful in prosecuting the war, unlike others who, Moshe Dayan, whoever, who somewhat fall apart.
If I may, just before addressing that question directly, I'd like to say describe a couple of ways in which these two books, namely Adjusting Sights and the new biography of Golda, intersect. And Mati just reminded me of them right now. The first way they intersect is circumstantially, in the sense that as labor minister from 1949 to 1956, which Golda called her seven beautiful years, among other things, she was building over 100 ma'abarot, temporary and often very crude camps for new immigrants. And as Mati mentioned, Chaim Sabato was born to a family of Aleppan Syrian descent in Cairo, and in the early 50s immigrated with his family to exactly such a ma'abara in the, I think it was the Kiryat HaYovel neighborhood of Jerusalem. So in some sense, there is a circumstantial, if you will, intersection point. There's also a deeper intersection point that relates to the last comments that Mati made. And that is to say, if you are weaving a memoir of a war and you find yourself resisting the conventions of chronology and ordering your narrative on an emotional order rather than a chronological one, I think there's a sense in which Deborah Lipstadt, although she's no novelist, was in a way that fascinated me, forced by her subject to take a similar stylistic strategy in telling the life of Golda. For example, you cannot help but, even if you want to approach a subject, a biographical subject, chronologically, you can't help but follow your own subject, if it's a subject like Golda, back into the realm of memory. So, for example, the scene which I begin the review, where it's 1946 and Golda is addressing the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry on Palestine and Jerusalem. And she begins by citing this dark elegy by Chaim Nachman Bialik about the 1903 Kishinev pogrom. So already there you have you as a writer, and therefore by extension as a reader, are forced into an achronological order of things, right? The state hasn't yet been born, and we're already back to some of Golda's first memories. And I think that's one of the very successful stylistic aspects of Deborah Lipstadt's book, that she's able, without, let's say, too much discombobulation, to very successfully interweave a, let's call it, a memory order rather than to follow a strictly the conventions of a strictly chronological order. So in those two respects, I think that there's actually some connection between these two books, because it's almost inevitable with Gold that we're always going back into historical memories, into resonances. She's meeting the Pope, right, in January 1973, and she's invoking, she's telling the Pope about her first memory, which is of a pogrom in when she was a small girl in Kiev. I mean, you can't help but to follow these memory interweavings rather than to take a strictly chronological, let's say, encyclopedia-like approach to the biographical subject.
That's a great moment when she confronts the Pope or rejects his criticism. Tell that story for a minute.
Well, it's January of 1973, and she becomes the first prime minister to be granted a papal audience. And she's sort of awed by the occasion and the symbolism of the moment. And she tells a member of her staff, she says, "Listen, what's going on here?" You know, with her kind of Milwaukee accent. "Me, the daughter of Moshe Mabovich the carpenter, going to meet the Pope of the Catholics." So one of the staff that's accompanying her says, "Well, actually, carpentry is a pretty respectable profession around here." And then she gets led into the room in the Apostolic Palace. And in her memory of it, she said that the Pope had said that he found it quite hard to understand that the Jewish people, who by all rights should be a merciful nation, has behaved so fiercely in its own country. And Golda just said, I can't stand it when we are talked to like that. As if the Catholics somehow have had a merciful history when it comes to the Jews. So in her reply, she said, "Your Holiness, you know what my earliest memory is? It's waiting for a pogrom in Kiev. When we were merciful, when we had no homeland, when we were weak, that's when we were led to the gas chambers." So to which apparently the Pope had not much of a reply. So again, you know, here's a way of drawing from 1903 Kishinev to her own childhood in the same years in Kiev to January of 1973, and thereby, in a kind of oblique way, to 2023. And reading this biography, you know, after October 7th, it was just a remarkable experience because of these memory jumps, because of the ways that a leader's memory of past persecutions, of past massacres, informed her emotional intelligence for her entire career.
So let's jump 10 months from January 73 to October. How does that failure come about? How does she loses apparently the sense of vulnerability, or it's simply an intelligence failure, but it seems to be more than that. Does Lipstadt give insight into what's going on there, what went on there?
Yeah, Lipstadt gives a very detailed account of the months and weeks preceding the Yom Kippur War, at the same time that Lipstadt acknowledges Golda's enormous composure in the conduct of that war. In contrast, as you yourself mentioned, to a very panicked Moshe Dayan, who urged her to accept a rather premature ceasefire from the Egyptian side. Meanwhile, she's battling lymphoma at the same time, which is not publicly disclosed. And she's drawing her strength in Lipstadt's telling from this almost mystical belief that we have to win. We have no other choice but to win. So I think that Lipstadt paints a rather nuanced picture between kind of acceding to the very stubbornly to the blindness, to a certain blindness to threats and warnings in the weeks before the surprise attack, but responding with composure once the war was being waged. And she also, Lipstadt also portrays Golda as behaving quite honorably when in the end the Commission of Inquiry finds fault, even though most of the fault led with her, with the IDF upper echelons and the chief of staff, rather than with her. that she resigned 9 days after the initial findings of the commission were made public.
And here, too, one is tempted to go to the present and even to the future and make comparisons. Is it possible yet, do you think, or Mati, you've written on intelligence, do you think, to compare the intelligence failures of Yom Kippur and Gaza?
Certainly, I think they're very similar. And we don't have a full picture yet of exactly what happened on October 7th, but it is clear that the failure is rooted in a concept. The military leadership and the political leadership have a concept, and they believe that they know what the enemy is thinking. And because they believe that they know what the enemy is thinking, they don't have to take seriously concrete signs that contradict what they believe. That happens in 1973, and the result is this incredible surprise attack on two fronts by the Egyptian army and the Syrian army on the holiest day of the Jewish year when Israel is fast asleep, and the results are more than 2,600 fatalities in the Israeli military in the space of 3 weeks of fighting, and a war that really shakes Israel to its core, changes the politics of Israel, it changes the culture of Israel. Of course, a few years later, the Likud comes to power for the first time, and that's directly connected to the war. Israel, after the 1973 war, is a different place. On October 7th, we have something very similar. We have this concept that Hamas in Gaza is deterred. They're not going to attempt some kind of dramatic attack. The army believes that its technology on the Gaza border is so advanced that the border is impenetrable, which is, by the way, something that Israel thought about the Suez Canal in 1973. And it's an illusion. Our sense of what our enemies are thinking is wrong. We dismiss warning signs. There are people in the intelligence world here who are warning of an impending Hamas attack, and they're told to stand down because the people at the top know what Hamas is thinking, so they don't have to worry about the signs that they're planning an attack. So the failures are very similar, and it might be just a human failure. It's not something specific to Israel. I think it makes sense that people develop certain concepts which are useful to them, right? Israel wants to believe that it has this under control so we can go on living and, selling startups to, investors and making movies for the Berlin Film Festival or whatever Israelis are up to. And we don't really want to think about the kind of enemy that we have in Gaza or what that enemy is planning to do the second that it's possible. And this comes crashing down on October 7th. In some ways, I think it's a worse failure. Because in 1973, the victims are soldiers. The number of soldiers that we lose throughout the Yom Kippur War is only twice the number of people who are killed on October 7th in one day.
Right.
And most of those people are civilians. This is a catastrophe that unfolds in people's kitchens and living rooms. And we're confronted with images that come from a different time in Jewish history, images from Poland in 1942, from Kishinev in 1903, from the Rhineland in 1099, and maybe even earlier. So in that way, it's an event that I think is a greater failure than the Yom Kippur War, and the price for it should be, at the very least, the resignation of the person at the top. Unfortunately, it's a different type of personality. Israel's best satire program, which is called Eretz Nehederet, or A Wonderful Country, had a skit about a month ago where Golda appears to Bibi. The ghost of Golda visits Bibi, like Hamlet. And these two leaders who are destroyed by the same kind of failure. And it's a very insightful sketch. I guess the question is, will Netanyahu be destroyed by this in the way that Golda was? Yes, I guess we'll see.
And if I may just add to Mati's remarks, it's not just a question of comparing complacency, security complacency, and disastrous intelligence gathering. It's also a question to me that Deborah Lipstadt raises of how internal rifts make a country vulnerable to the kind of surprise attacks in October 1973 and October 2023. If I can add a personal note, this last summer, I went to the premiere of the Golda movie, which was held facing the old city walls of Jerusalem in a beautiful outdoor setting. Helen Mirren, who plays Golda Meir, gave a talk, and so did President Herzog. Now, President Herzog's address was drowned out by chants from the stands. Demokratia, demokratia. In other words, it was an extension of these weekly protests that both Matti and I went to on Saturday nights. That, to me, I was thinking about that atmosphere. I couldn't help but invoking that atmosphere of the summer when that was the main issue of the day. To as I said, how internal rifts of a society must be healed before that society can effectively confront its external threats.
Well, that's a somber note on which perhaps to end. But I do want to thank you both for writing such great, if somber, pieces for this issue. We've heard from a lot of readers, and it was obviously a difficult issue to put together, precisely because we are living in this moment. And I'm so grateful to you both for contributing. If it's possible to think ahead to the next thing for you both living in Jerusalem right now, what's your next project?
Before I try to think up an answer to that question, Abe, I just want to say that we're talking about jumping between different historical periods and the very unique kind of perspective you get from being immersed in Jewish culture, which, you know, if you think too much about the Holocaust or about the Romans, it can freak you out, or it can be comforting in a very strange way. And I think that the Jewish Review of Books really does that. You read an issue of the Jewish Review of Books, and, you know, one article is about, you know, purity in the Persian Empire, and then you're in medieval Germany, and then you're in World War II, and then you're in the State of Israel. And there's something deeply Jewish about that style of jumping around. And it reminds us that things are bad now. They've been bad before, but here we are still writing and talking. So, you know, the future must be there, even if we don't exactly know what it looks like. I'm trying to write about this war, as I usually do, from the margins, not cover the straight news story of the war, but to try to think about the ripple effects this is having in Israeli culture. I'm writing right now about music, about what I think might be the most apt song at this moment, and just as a way of looking at the war and at the way Israeli culture deals with tragedies of this kind. So that's what I'm working on right now. And eventually I hope to get back to writing the longer projects that I was planning before October 7th, but the events here certainly are not great for focus and concentration.
I understand. Ben, your book on Bruno Schultz just won a big prize. And perhaps it's hard to think about the next book, but what is the next book or the next big thing?
Well, just today I finished the latest book from the Romanian Jewish writer Norman Manea. He's been in American exile from the Ceausescu regime in the States since 1986. And at the same age that Golda was experiencing her first pogrom, that is age 5, Norman Manea was deported with his family to a concentration camp in Transnistria, and emerged only 4 years later. And essentially, this novel is a lifelong uncoiling of that childhood experience. And it relates in part to what we've said today about Jewish memory and the echoings, the inevitable echoings of Jewish memory. So I think that'll be my next piece, I hope, for the Jewish Review of Books.
I hope so too. I'm tempted to quote Shalom Aleichem here, but let's talk about cholera in Odessa. thank you both so much. It's always good to see and to talk to you, and even more, or perhaps most especially to read you. Thank you very much. Thanks again to Ben Balint and Mati Friedman for coming on to the Jewish Review of Books podcast, which was produced by our associate editor, Akiva Schick. You can read their articles and listen to more episodes at jewishreviewofbooks.com. And please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or Google Podcast. Oh, and please leave us a 5-star rating. The algorithm likes it, and we'd appreciate it too. Meanwhile, keep reading.